I'm going to begin this way, maybe with a bit of a thought experiment. You can close your eyes if you want, but let's do this. Let's pretend it's the second century. You are a recent convert to Christianity. You're living in the city of Rome. In many ways, you're in the most civilized city in the world. The aqueducts can be heard bringing water into the city. But it's night, and you are part of a small group of people who, since you started exploring Christianity and since you were baptized, you have frequently made your trips in the evening, and you head out of the city with this group. And there's a repulsive smell that you start to pick up the further you get away from the city, and you continue to move towards that smell. It's a mixture of trash and of things being burnt. But every night, there you go with this group of people, and you walk around this trash heap, which is absolutely disgusting, in silence. You're listening for one thing, the sound of abandoned babies who've been thrown into the trash heap, which is common practice at Rome in this time. And you're going to take these babies and you're going to raise them in your house. And this is what the church has been doing for years, and you're now part of this great movement. Let's say now it's the 4th century. You're in Athens, Greece, another high point of civilization. And the past couple of days have been filled with loud sounds, people moving to and fro through the city, animals moving rapidly through the city. But now, all is well and all is quiet. In fact, it's an eerie type of quiet. But in the midst of the quiet, you can occasionally hear loud moans. And as you leave your home and you walk through the city, it feels as though a zombie apocalypse has hit the city, because again, a plague has swept into the city. And the people of Athens did what everyone does when plagues hit the city. They flee the city, at least for a season. Some may never come back. And they leave behind all the sick, the dying, and those in need of help. And you're a Christian living in the city of Athens. And what do? You do what all the other Christians have done so many plagues before. You open up your house. And with a group of people, you travel through the city listening for the moaning. And you invite people into your home. You give them a bed. You take the best care of them you can, slaves, elderly, people who hate you, people who love you, and you help them die well with dignity. Now let's say it's the 16th century, or it could be anywhere up to the 12th century, and society's in a state of constant flux. Christianity's been generally accepted, and it's been hard to figure out what it looks like to be a Christian in places like, say, Alexandria in Egypt. In the midst of this change, a group of Christians has decided that they're going to move outside of the city along a trade route. They're going to establish a big house with a fence around it, with a huge gate around it, and they're going to try to figure out what it means to live in a house together and practice the love of Jesus, sisters and brothers together, what it looks like to be the people that follow Jesus in this particular world. And as you move there, you are quickly promoted to a special job. You work your way up the ranks, and you're promoted to the job of porter. But there's a 2-year training process before you can become the porter, because it's the job of the porter to live at the gate of the city and to be constantly on the lookout down these trade routes, waiting for anyone who might come, that you might welcome them in and invite them in as though they belong in this particular town. 17th century now. Let's say you're in Geneva in Switzerland. France is in a bit of an upheaval. The St. Bartholomew Day Massacre has slaughtered many Protestant Christians. Here you are in Geneva, your town is still trying to figure out whether they're going to be Catholic or Protestant. You're just trying to figure out what it means to follow Christ. And yet, all these refugees are coming from France. And what do? Pastor stands up in Geneva, preaches a sermon, and says we need to welcome these people. And sure enough, every family in the church that has any sort of means opens up their home. And homes that were made to have just one family live in them, at least for a season, have two French-speaking families that call this place home. These are all a bit abstract. Let's bring it closer to home. It's the 19th century. You're in Ancaster, Ontario, just outside of Hamilton, for those of you who never leave the GTA. And you are a part of a church in which you are regularly hearing a call from the minister to give sacrificially both your time and your money to a place called the Griffin House. Because slavery's been outlawed in the British Empire for a couple of years, but it is still raging in the U.S. And every day, there are men and women and children who've been led through the Underground Railroad, and the last stop is the Griffin House in Ancaster, Ontario, where they're given a place to stay, and they're taught life skills that they might survive, that they might conduct their life. And every day you look out in the house, as you serve at this house, you look out and what do you see? You see a man and his pregnant wife who can't fathom the idea that their child would be born into slavery. You see a man and a woman who's clearly been abused for some time, and the man is protecting his wife by bringing her here. And what do? You, with the other Christians in Ancaster, open your house. You let these former slaves be treated as sisters and brothers. You help reestablish them in society. Maybe even a little closer to home. It's the 20th century. You're at the height of your academic career. Some of you might not have a hard time imagining that. The rest of us do. And you've taught at Notre Dame. You've taught at the prestigious Yale. And you just received your post at Harvard. And you're secure in your post in Harvard. You are publishing regularly. Your reputation, your renown is spreading. But something feels off. You've been telling one of your friends that you've been feeling lost and filled with self-doubt. You're not sure what you're going to do. And this friend, a Frenchman, recommends that you stay at a place called L'Arche, Daybreak, up in Richmond Hill, not that far from here. On a Sunday, you could probably get there in 45 minutes. And in the midst of your academic prowess and career, you stay for a week at L'Arche. You decide you're done. You're not going to go back to the academy, but you're going to devote your whole life to living in this intentional community, which is for the intellectually disabled, for those who are developmentally disabled. You are going to get rid of the academic life, and you are going to live in this community with a roommate whose name is Adam Arnett, who can hardly speak, who frequently has seizures. And for the rest of your life, you're going to figure out what it means to practice the love of Christ in this community called L'Arche in Richmond Hill. Now, why do I share these stories? Try to give you something to listen to. Try to give you something entertaining. But why I share these stories is this. Whatever happens when Christianity comes into an area, when people start laying hold of the resurrection of Christ, all kinds of things start to change. But one thing that is without fail that starts to change is the household. Households are treated differently. They're dealt with differently after the good news of Jesus comes into a community. What it means to be a household is utterly transformed. And what I want to look at is, why is that? What does it look like in our day and age, in a place in the city like we have here in the East End? What does it look like to be a people in this long legacy of saying, Jesus has died, Jesus has risen from the dead, I am following him, and now my household is going to be used that it might advance his kingdom? This is what I want to think about today. And what I want to look at today is what the resurrection teaches us about God's plan for his household, and what the resurrection teaches us about God's call to our household. So the resurrection and God's plan for his household, and then we'll look at the call to our household. Let me give you a little bit of background about this piece of scripture that we read, because we're coming into the letter about halfway through. The Apostle Paul was a church planner, and he had planted this church in Ephesus. And it had done well while he was there, but it was predominantly a Jewish group of believers. And after he left, though, this church that he started began to spread like weeds throughout the city of Ephesus. And it was predominantly spreading with Gentile Christians. So that now the city of Ephesus is filled with all these households that gather on Sunday morning in these little house churches who sing songs to Jesus' name, turn their attention to his word. And they're trying to figure out how in the world they're all going to get along. Because these Jews and these Gentiles have so much prejudice built up, so much animosity towards one another after years and years of problems with one another. They're trying to figure out what it looks like to say, we both believe Jesus Christ is the king of this world. And what Paul's doing in this letter is he's looking at the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, and he's trying to help these people make sense of their present situation. There's been some sort of radical transition in what it means to be the people of God now because of Jesus, and he's trying to help them see. And verse 19 is the key. Let your eyes look down at verse 19 in the bulletin. I stumbled as I read it, just so you wouldn't forget it. Verse 19, Paul says that the Gentile outsiders have been brought into God's household. Now, let me just say this. You remember this timeline that we've been working on for how the resurrection works. All of God's people thought God created the world. The world screwed up. And at some point, God was going to come down in judgment. He was going to judge the earth and then put all things to right, release a new power and recreate the world. And the mystery of the resurrection of Jesus is that right in the middle of history, that timeline gets transformed. Because Jesus comes into the world, he dies, God judges him in the middle of history. He's deemed to be righteous in the right, good enough, pleasing to the Father. So God resurrects him from the dead in the middle of history, and he begins to unleash that power to recreate the world in the middle of history. This is how the timeline is upended. And this is a huge deal because what Paul's saying in this passage is that what happened at the resurrection of Jesus, as this power was unleashed, that the former way of life in which people were held in animosity to one another by sort of demonic and spiritual forces, where there were Jew and Gentile and constantly in clash and tension, these things have been transformed by the power of Jesus' resurrection. Former strangers and aliens can now be brought into God's household. Now, what does this mean? Well, Paul was a good Jew. He grew up reading his Old Testament, and he understood the Bible to speak this way. God lives in a realm called heaven, a mysterious realm called heaven, but he creates the earth. And as we read the Bible, the earth is almost like his second property, maybe, his Muskoka cottage of sorts. He purchased this second home, and he interacts with this home, and he's proud of this home, and he builds this home, but his primary dwelling is in heaven. But on the earth, he intends to spread his household. And so on this sort of second property, he plants and prepares a garden, and he makes these first human beings, and he welcomes them to dwell under his protective care and in his presence, in his household of sorts, in this garden. And the task of the first human beings were to have children and to expand this boundary of the garden, to have more households live within God's household, if that makes sense, to expand the boundaries of this garden so that there'd be more people dwelling in God's household. This was sort of the trajectory the Bible puts us on. But as you know, the first human beings rejected God's care. They wouldn't play by the house rules, and they're expelled. They're alienated from the household of God. But God doesn't give up. And the story of the Bible is him not just rescuing individuals, but him coming about rescuing entire households. Because almost immediately after they're kicked out of the garden, what do we find? There's one man who's said to be righteous named Noah, and God rescues him and his household. He says, build a boat, move your whole family on the boat. I'm going to wash the earth. I'm going to flood the whole earth because I want to fix this thing. It's gone out of control. You and your family, you and your household, move everything onto this boat and be saved. And not long after that, he makes himself known to a man named Abraham, and he said, your household is going to become a multinational household. It's going to become sort of an international renown. I am going to bless your household so that your household could be a blessing to others, and they could bring more households into my blessing. So this is the whole promise of the nation of Israel. The nation itself was the household of God in many ways. This is what all this business of a tabernacle and a temple is about. God is dwelling with this nation as they try to live their life on his earth. They become the household of God. They dwell together with one another. And the tragedy of the Bible is that Israel fails to be a true household. In many ways, we see that they would prefer to watch out for their own nuclear families. They become obsessed with their nuclear families. And rather than doing what they were called to do, to expand their household, to bring outsiders in, to welcome them into their household, that they might dwell with God and with one another and this land that God had given them, they hoard this land, they hoard this blessing to themselves. And this is why God sends Jesus. They failed to be true housekeepers. And God sends Jesus to dwell or to tabernacle amongst people. And in sending Jesus, Jesus comes, and he's constantly dealing with households. I won't belabor the point, but you see him constantly eating in households. The kids may remember the song about Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus, you come down, for I'm going to your house today. You know, Jesus cares a ton about this household, this idea of households. And after he dies, after he resurrects, he said, I'm going to prepare a place for you, a house, a dwelling place where we can all live together. This is why in the book of Acts, when people declare their allegiance to Jesus, when they say, I want to be a follower of Jesus, they are baptized. But we're told constantly, they are baptized, they and their house. Okay, this is what God's doing. He's out to rescue households. He's on a mission to expand his household into other households. And so the resurrection says this, that God wants his house full. He wants it filled up with households. His house filled up with households. That's what he is all about, and that's why he sent Jesus. Let me say this to try to grab your attention. Unless you were in a coma yesterday, and if you were in a coma yesterday, I'm very sorry. Don't mean to speak lightly of it. But unless you were in a coma yesterday, there was a royal wedding. It was kind of a big deal. It was all over Facebook. Everyone was talking about it. It got unbelievable coverage. And I caught myself watching it on repeat. And this is what the royal wedding, in some senses, was all about. What's happening in this passage, what God has done in Jesus, was sort of depicted in the royal wedding in this way. Meghan Markle, you know, an outsider, an alien to the promises, probably has never ridden on a carriage ride prior to Harry, I'm guessing, you know, a foreigner to all the promises and titles that belong to the British royal family. She is being brought in. She's a duchess. She is now has a status that was no longer hers. And this is what Paul is saying is happening. He's saying this. He's saying, by the resurrection of Jesus, Jesus has come and he is for us the means by which we receive things that formerly did not belong to us, namely a place in God's household. Let me illustrate it this way. Hang in there. Try to listen. Try to hear me out on this. I've heard this story before, and I was told the story as though it was a true story, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's true. But the story goes something like this. There was a family that I was told had been trying for a long time to get pregnant, and they finally discovered that they were unable to ever be pregnant due to infertility problems. They're unable to have children. And so they decide that they are going to pursue adoption. And it's a long path for adoption domestically, but they find out that in Ukraine, they have a connection through the church to a particular orphanage that has children that are available to be adopted almost immediately. And they decide that it is. They decide that without question, they feel this is what the Lord has gone to them to do. They're going to adopt a little boy from the Ukraine. And so they begin interacting with the orphanage, and they find out that there's a boy named Joshua. He's 5 years old. He's a bit old for adoption, but he desperately needs parents, and they decide, this must be what the Lord is calling us to do. And so they pack up their bags. They do all the paperwork. They clear everything, weeks and weeks and weeks of preparing for this adoption. And they get ready to go visit Joshua, and they bring toys for him and candy. And they arrive in the Ukraine, and they're brought into the orphanage, and they are just overwhelmed by what they see. Kids laying on top of kids, kids everywhere you could look, very few adults. Just a horrible, horrible thought to believe that kids are living there. And they finally introduced to Joshua, and they're brought to a private room, and they show him the toys that are now his. And he'd never owned toys before. You know, this was overwhelming. And they show him this candy, and they're coming from North America, so it's probably more sugar than he's ever had in his entire life. You know, he's on a sugar buzz. And things seem great. Speaking through a translator, it seems like there's a great connection almost immediately. And this couple is beyond ecstatic at what God has done. All the trials they went through led them to this, and they feel as though this must be the Lord's doing. And they stay there for a couple of days at the orphanage, waiting for the final paperwork to all be cleared, making sure everything's in order, until it becomes the day that they're going to head back to North America. They're going to head home. And as the story goes, as I'm told, they told Joshua that it was time for him to go. The director of the orphanage brought them together and said, Joshua, it's time for you to leave. And Joshua had this confused look on his face, and he sprinted away into this cavernous orphanage, and he was hiding. And for some time, the director of the orphanage and the parents looked around. They couldn't seem to find Joshua. And eventually they found him tucked back in a utility closet, holding on to another little boy's hand, gripping this boy's hand so tight. And the director of the orphanage spoke to him in Ukraine and said, it's time to go. And he said, I'm not leaving. And they tried to reason with him, and he said, I'm not leaving. And after some time, the director of the orphanage said, this is going to be painful, but I know you're going to thank me for it one day. He begins to move in and actually physically try to separate Joshua from this other little boy. And at this point, Joshua lays hold of this boy, hugs him so tight, clings to him so tight that there is no separating them. And he screams out, which is eventually translated to the parents, I'm not leaving without my brother. And the parents decide that he doesn't need to leave without his brother. As the story, as I'm told, went, they stay there until they can adopt both of them. And they bring both of them back and give both of them a new life. This is the story of the gospel in a nutshell. Jesus came, and he was a human being just like you and me. Took on all the skin, the frailty, the complications of human life just like you and me. And what he did in his work is he laid hold of you and me. He grabbed us by our legs, by our hands, and he says, I'm not going anywhere without my brother, without my sister. I'm not going unless you bring them. And his father doesn't put up a fight. His father said, my house has many, many rooms. I want this household expanded. I want everyone brought in. And this is what the gospel is all about. Jesus went and he found a way in which we could all be brought into this household of God. This is what Jesus does for us. And Paul is telling us, because of what Jesus did in his life and his death and his resurrection, you now have a chance to be brought into the household of God. Because of who Jesus is, because he laid hold of you this way and told his father, there's no way I'm leaving without my siblings, you are brought into this family, Jew and Gentile. People who look different, people who look the same. They're all brought in to this particular family. All are brought into God's house who lay hold of Christ by faith. This is what we learn about God's household. He wants this thing filled up. The resurrection tells us that God's plan for his household is that all might be brought in as they lay hold of Christ and as Christ lays hold of them. All might be brought into this house. This is why the household, though, is forever changed. And I just want to spend the last part of our time thinking about what this means then for our households. Because I led with a series of ways in which Christians realized their household was to model what God has done for them. By bringing them into the household, they were now to bring others in. That's what all those stories were about the sick and dying and the slaves, about the castaways from society. All these people saw that when they were there, God sent Christ for them to bring them in. So this now has something to say about our particular household. Now, Paul, not so much in this passage, but really in the whole rest of the letter, he is going to unpack this principle that if God welcomed us in, then we are to welcome others in. And we see two things of what God has done for us in Jesus that Paul's going to then emulate throughout the rest of the book of Ephesians. But in verse 13, let your eyes see, we read that we were brought in, that we have access to the Father, that that's part of what Jesus did. He brought all of us in. And the second thing we see in verse 22 is that we are being built up for a dwelling place with God. So what Paul's doing in this passage and what he's going to do throughout the rest of the book of Ephesians is he's going to say, if God did that to you, then here's what that means to live into that and to live out into our world with this mindset. And this is why the household gets transformed. If Jesus brought us into God's household, then it must be our practice to bring others into ours. Does that make sense? The logic is pretty straightforward. This is a huge part, though, of why I wanted to plant this church in this area. I mean, there's all kinds of crazy urban trends right now where the houses are becoming almost like barracks. You know, they hardly even have a washroom anymore. They're really tiny. They're becoming extremely private places where you go to be sort of a recluse when you want to be away from people. But here in this part of the city, we have a high percentage of people owning homes that have neighbors. You're going to live next to these people for some time. And part of why I wanted to plant a church in this city is we have to figure out, what do we do with these households? They're wonderful assets. What do we do with these brick and mortar? And how do we follow Jesus inside of these things so that somehow we make a difference in this part of the city because of who Jesus is and what he has done for us? We live in a city that's so desperately lonely, so desperately isolated. What does it mean to be people who say our household is always open? And I'd say in part, what we got to start doing, and I didn't plan to say it maybe this way, but what we've got to be careful to do is a reputation might spread that this is sort of a family church, partially because we have this massive army of kids that overwhelm us every Sunday, and it is actually overwhelming sometimes. Most of them are mine, but I'm trying to slow down on that trend. But an idea could be brought about that we're somehow a family church. And there's something not evil about that. But boy, we've got to get away with this obsession with the nuclear family, right? I mean, like, our society is just so obsessed with the nuclear family. We need to find a way to flip that and say we're not necessarily a family church, but we are a church full of households. And we're a bunch of people who want to use our household to say we were welcomed into God's household. Now we are constantly welcoming others into households. That includes kids, you know, who probably are going to break something or going to stain something you don't want stained. We're going to be the type of church where our households are constantly open. Our instincts are to constantly welcome the outsider. This is what we've experienced from God in Christ. We are a people who believe God dwells with us and brings us into his household, then we have to welcome others. Let me give you maybe something to think about. I mean, there are people in this church doing this so incredibly well. Some people are doing it before the church was planted that are just inspiring me like crazy. You know, there are nights where people in this church have friends who are depressed, who sleep on their couch for their own safety, to know that they're going to get through this thing. And while they've got thoughts that are just unhealthy, there are people in this church who say, you are always welcome to come on our couch. You're dealing with this depression, you're dealing with whatever you're going through, you are always welcome to sleep on our couch till we get better, till you get through this. There are people in this church that are welcoming refugees. There are people in this church that are opening up their, you know, basement apartments for low rent, for people who are trying to wrestle through difficult things in life. This has got to be part of the vision of us as a church. How do we use these households that we have to bring about glory towards God's name? Maybe one way to think about what I'm trying to say is this. I'd hope we'd be the type of church when everyone leaves for church on Sunday where we set the table, and every Sunday we set one or two extra plates, one or two extra glasses and cutlery, just assuming if anyone visits our church, you better believe they're going to have a place to eat with somebody else, you know? What would it look like to be a church like that? A church where hosting cousins, neighbors, university students, teenagers, and fights with their parents, that our homes are always known as a place where you can come and dwell here because we believe that God has invited us in to dwell in his household, and now he is teaching us to work out what it means to be part of his household in our particular households. This is part of what we need to become as a church. Look, it means you're going to get your nap schedule screwed up. It means at times you're going to have lower standard meals that you can make more quickly. But part of what I'm trying to say is, in our walk with Jesus Christ, in what it means to say the resurrected Jesus brought us into the household of God, this must then sort of make an impact and make a dent on how we conduct our lives in our house. God dwells with us now. Our homes need to become a place where we remind ourselves of that. But it's not just that we need to invite outsiders in. We also need to use our house as a place in which we are being built up. We need to see our household as little schools, little Bible schools, little monasteries, whatever makes you least uncomfortable, little places by which we order our life so that we're built up towards love of God and love of neighbor in all we do. We need to figure out how to create a culture in our home where that is the case, an atmosphere where our kids and anyone who comes in knows that our highest priority is to figure out what it looks like to use our life towards love of God and love of neighbor. This is a bit what this whole series has been about and what I've been trying to say, and maybe just to speak off the cuff. What I've been going for is this, that we have to be a church that figures out what it means to say Jesus Christ rose from the dead and really nothing else matters. I will follow him and do whatever he says. All of his life is all that he says he is now the authority over my life. All of my life is now lived all for Christ. All that I have, all for this risen Christ. And what that has to look like is it has to pour out and it has to make an impact in our home. So maybe I'll draw this thing in conclusion this way. God is building us up as a household. He is not. He doesn't see you just as individuals. When he looks down from heaven, he actually sees households. And he's calling you fathers. He's calling you mothers. He's calling you, person who lives by yourself. He's calling all of you to figure out how to use this household to bring about the spread of God's kingdom in this particular world. How to use this household to say that's a house where they believe Jesus rose from the dead. And so here we are. We're in the 21st century. Maybe with a touch of luck, maybe with a touch of privilege. A high percentage of us own homes in a city that people want to live in, that people are migrating to regularly. And it's a city where the majority of people are moving into postage stamp condos, tiny condos, which they can't hardly ever host anybody. But what would it look like for one church in this part of the city with these kind of assets to believe that God dwells with us in our household? What would it look like to be a church that welcomes outsiders in, builds people up, so the city is never the same? Let me pray.